Okay, I think we go ahead and get started. So, welcome all to Q&A. And as always, so muted everybody. You have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. The deck, the audio recording, as well as contents of the chat window will be going up on the website either tonight or tomorrow. And if you have any questions or comments or that, you can put them into the chat window as well, and we can take up those as we run out of other prepared material. So with that, I think I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And we do have a fair amount of prepared material. But as usual, we should have some time at the end for your questions. And I see there's already one in the chat. So if anybody has an answer to that, we would appreciate it. Okay, so starting off, I have a computer basics item. And a while ago, I talked about customizing the start menu and how to make it bigger and how to change the icons and so on. And this time I want to take a look at the bottom of the screen, which is the Microsoft taskbar. And you see that outlined in red there. So question is, how do we change that? And well, the way we get started, at least, is to right-click the mouse on the taskbar, and this context menu will pop up, and we select the taskbar settings. And then we can do things like we can move the taskbar around. For example, here I've chosen to display the taskbar on the left rather than on the bottom. And you can see that you can also move it to the other edges of the screen if you so wish. And then the next thing is, if we want to change things on the taskbar, typically we have to choose this right-click again on the taskbar and choose this and lock all taskbars and turn that off, disable it, in other words. And then once you've done that, you can start moving things around. And one of the things, if you have lots and lots of icons and they won't fit on the horizontal real estate on your desktop screen, you can actually grab hold of the top of the taskbar and drag it up and basically make it a lot deeper, and then your icons will spill out into a second line, for example, if you have so many of them. However, what I do is I actually just move the icons around so that they're in the places that I like them. So with the taskbar unlocked, for example, I can take Thunderbird here and I can move it over so it's basically on the right-hand side normally, on the right-hand side of the Vivaldi browser, for example. So with the taskbar unlocked, I just have to grab the map, grab the icon, drag it across to the right, let go, and now I've rearranged the icons on my taskbar. And while I'm there, I'm left-clicking and right-clicking things, and notice that there's a whole bunch of other stuff. There's this thing down here called People, which I never use. There's this weather forecast type thing, which is actually a news and interest item, which again, I never use. And then down here's an interesting one, this chevron, which is like a holding bay for all kinds of icons that aren't really used, but they're available if you need them. So we'll get to that one in a minute. But basically, I never use People, I never use the weather forecasting. So personally, I'd actually quite like to get rid of those. So again, we can right click this time on the little people icon here. And then if you look at the context menu, you'll find this show people on the taskbar is checked. So again, you basically uncheck that and the thing eventually will go away. Same thing with the or more or less the same thing with the weather. We right-click on the news and interests, and then if you hover over this thing, you'll get this submenu coming up, and you can basically say, turn it off. And then the final thing I talked about, the chevron. When you click on the chevron, here are all these icons which I was talking about that you normally don't see. For example, there's some updates available in Windows Defender. The one I actually like is this little guy right here, which is the eject the USB flash drive icon. So rather than having to click on the chevron to access this all the time, once I've opened up the menu of the icons, I can actually grab the icon and drag it down to the taskbar, and then it will stay on the taskbar. And by the same token, Chris tells me that if you have lots of icons down here and you want to get rid of some of them, but not completely, just make them available sometime, you can go the other way around. You can grab an icon and drag it into this holding bay, and then it will sit basically underneath the chevron until you're ready to use it. So basically, I've got rid of people, I've got rid of the weather forecast, I've moved the eject media down to the taskbar. So now, here is the final product. And notice I've got rid of the extraneous icons that I don't want. But now I have the eject icon readily available if I want to safely eject my inserted flash drive. Okay, so there we go. That's how, at least that's how I modify the taskbar, and that's how you can modify all kind of aspects of your taskbar, should you so wish.
Just a small clarification on that. This is dealing with the system notification area, which is everything that is to the right of that chevron. So it's not dealing with the left-hand side of the taskbar. Any of the icons you move in and out of that hidden area will always show up. It'll be to the right of the chevron, not to the left of the chevron.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, normally on my desktop, there's a huge space between the left group of icons and the right group of icons, because I don't actually have that many icons on the taskbar.
Yeah.
Okay, good point, Chris. Thanks. And moving along, Chris has a computer basics item on the Microsoft Store.
Yeah, this is something I just happened across that I thought was a little bit strange. I always thought that the Microsoft Store apps updated themselves, and by default, they're supposed to. But in my experience on my computers, it seems to be a bit hit and miss as to whether they are being updated, either whether they're being updated at all or whether they're being updated in a timely fashion. I figure it's a good thing to check. And you want to check a couple of things, your settings for automatic updates to make sure it is set to automatically update them, and then see if any of your apps are not updating correctly and need to be manually pushed to do the update. So next. So the way you get to this is you go to the Microsoft Store. And so to do that, the easiest I find is just click on the Start button and then just start typing in Store. And then the best match will pop up with Microsoft Store. When it does, hit Enter or click on it, and that'll load the Store if it's not already on your taskbar. Next, which it is on. Seems on some computers they put the Microsoft Store app by default. It shows up. It's pinned to your taskbar. So next. And so once the Store app loads, you have your profile picture that is on the title bar for it. And if you click your profile picture, next, it'll end up coming up with a menu drop down from the profile picture. And choose the app settings down at the bottom, next. And then make sure that it is set to app updates is turned on, where it says updates app automatically. It should be on by default, and it was on mine, but that doesn't necessarily mean that absolutely everything really is updating in a timely fashion. But good to check that the setting is there. So the next thing you want to do is check to see whether any of your apps actually do need updates right now. So back at the main screen of the Store app, you click on the library icon, next. And then it comes up with, and this is what it came up with on mine, that there were 13 updates available. Now, if they're supposed to be updating by themselves, I can't imagine 13 updates or, you know, just happened in the last hour or even day or anything like that. I don't think they're being updated in a timely fashion, if at all. So time will tell whether I see you know, other apps that do update correctly. But anyway, next. So update available. It sorts those apps that do require an update to the top of the list, so you don't have to scroll through your entire list of installed store apps, which there could be dozens. If you look at the size of the scroll bar on the screen, you can see that I have quite a list of store apps that are installed in this computer. So you can easily scroll through and see those apps that actually do require an update. Next. You can also click, and this is a bit of a misnomer, that rather than saying get updates, it should be saying check for updates, because that button, if you click it, it will actually just go out and check to see if there are any additional ones that since the last time it checked to see whether something needs an update, and it'll update the list of number of updates that are available for you. Next. And then you have two choices. You can update all, and it'll just go through all of the ones where it says update available, and it'll update them. Or you can go to individual apps and click the update button for it to update just single apps at a time. Now, quite frankly, on store apps, I recommend that people just do an update all. I don't know if there's any reason why you would decide that a store app shouldn't be updated. You know, it's really hard to see what it is that has been updated in the app. I always figure there's a chance of security updates, and so I just update them all. So the lesson learned on this one really is that I think periodically it's a good idea to check in the Microsoft Store to see if any of the store apps have updates available for them and call for them and install them if it does show them as being required. So that's it for Microsoft Store updates.
Thanks, Chris. There's a comment in the chat. It says, make sure the location on your system matches the location on the store profile, or you may not be able to download apps you have on other computers, let alone update them. Found this out after a new OS install.
Very strange.
Hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't know why. It sounds very odd why they would care about location, but okay. I'll actually check that on my computer and see if maybe that's what causing the problem of that the updates are not happening automatically. They certainly did. When I clicked on update all, they very quickly went in, updated all the apps for me, and it was fine. So, but I'll check that. Cool.
Okay. All right. A question came in earlier today. Somebody who no longer has a floppy disk drive, but has a whole bunch of floppy disks and was thinking of taking them to Staples to be recycled. Most of them were old computer software programs, installation software, but some of them had personal data files on. So the question was, is there any security risk for the personal data ones? Well, for any of the floppies, I guess, but especially the personal data ones. And the question really was, or should I dispose of them myself with a hammer? So it turns out this individual did call Staples, and they do actually recycle floppy disks, which I didn't know, but there you go. So if you have a whole rack of floppy disks, you can recycle them at Staples. I don't believe there's any issues with commercial software. It's probably way out of date, and there's nothing private on it. However, if I had drives with personal data, floppy drives especially, I would actually get rid of those. And the way I would do it is to basically just take the disk apart. If you break open the plastic shell, and you'll find inside the actual floppy disk is this piece of plastic film with a metal hub which actually connects to the drive to spin the disk around. And because it's a plastic film, you can basically just take a pair of scissors and shred the floppy disk so that nobody else can read it, and then just discard it in the garbage, I would think. Okay, and a second question Chris is going to deal with.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. This one came in from Carol Pearson, and she was getting an error message every time she was starting up her HP laptop. And the computer did seem to run fine, but she thinks it was maybe a little bit slower. And reading the alert that actually came up, It said the BIOS detected that capacity of the internal battery has been reduced, could be caused by environmental factors such as low ambient operating temperature, or it could be due to aging of the battery pack. And it gives an error code, and it gave you a URL, which actually fails. It fails with a 404 page not found, which I thought was very interesting. So next. So she had the questions, what does she need to do? And she doesn't think it's temperature related because it's basically the computer has sat on a desk in the same position since she first started using the computer. So it's not that it's low temperature or anything like that. She asked, will it work as long as it's plugged in? Will it go dark at any time? And she's doing frequent backups just in case. And I'd like to point out here, doing frequent backups is a very, very good idea, not only if you're having error messages popping up on screen, but doing frequent backups is a good thing to do under any circumstance because you never know what may fail on your computer. So kudos to you to do the backups, but keep doing them. Next. So I think it really was aging battery. So the 601 error code, I actually looked that up. I did a Google search for it, and there is another page that HP has on their website, and I give the URL there, and I will paste all of this into the chat right now as well. Excuse me, just a second. And so, there's two things that it talked about. It said measured storage capacity of the battery is less than 25% of the original storage capacity, and they say it may be caused by aging of battery pack, and I think that that truly is what the actual error was. Next. So the suggestions from HP, update the BIOS was one of the things they had, which I thought was really a little bit strange, but I seriously doubt that that would help in this particular circumstance. But they also have a testing capability in HP computers. And so when you turn on your computer and you immediately press the escape key, you'll get a startup menu. And if you choose system diagnostics with the F2 key, you will have an option for battery test. So I would suggest doing it, but I bet you it's just going to come back and say that, yes, the battery has got a capacity of less than 25% of the original storage capacity, which is what the error message told you anyways. Next. So what do you do then? So the battery report is very likely to say that the battery needs replacing. So I don't know about the particular model that Carol has, but if the battery is used replaceable and you want to go to the expense of replacing it, then go for it. It's not likely in modern laptops. Most modern laptops are sealed, and so you'll have to start unscrewing things and maybe getting rid of glue and things like that on the inside to replace a battery. So you could try it if you go to Google University on your particular model and ask about battery replacement. You'll probably find somebody who will tell you how to do it. Again, that's only if you want to go to the expense. So if the battery is not used or replaceable, you could send it to a computer store and have them replace it, again, at a cost. So do you really want to go to that expense or not? Next. So, but Carol did say that the computer had been in the same spot since she's owned it. So I presume plugged in all the time. And so do you really worry about it, the fact that the battery is essentially non-functioning at this point in time, or might only function for a couple of minutes if you try to run it on battery? So it will continue to function as long as it is plugged in. So there's no danger to that. There is some warning if you have user replaceable batteries. Before you actually unplug the battery and plug it in just on its power cord, check with the manufacturer. Some laptop computers would function fine if you take the battery out of it and just plug it in. Some of them, they say you have to have the battery actually installed in the computer in order to have it plugged into the wall. So if you do want to run that way and you are able to pull the battery from the computer, check with the manufacturer first to see if it's safe to do so. Next. Now, I really like questions like this coming in because it gives me a chance to step back and look at things from a broader sense. So the whole idea of taking care of batteries, there's a lot of conflicting advice out there, but generally speaking, most of the advice I see out here is talking about this. And so that URL, I pasted that into the chat as well, seemed to be a pretty good site for talking about how to take care of lithium-ion batteries. If you leave them plugged in all the time, over a period of time, usually a period of a couple of years, it will end up losing its capability to hold a charge. And it may go down to the point where it essentially will last for a minute before the computer will just, you know, stop functioning if you're trying to run it on the battery. Ideally, you should not fully charge and you should not fully discharge a lithium ion battery. So I think that the advice not to fully charge is probably pretty impractical. When you want to charge up your computer, typically you don't really want to sit there monitoring, oh, when is it at 90% charge so that you can unplug it. So I think most people just fully charge it. It is more practical to not leave it in after it's fully charged. So if you plug it in, you come back 2 or 3 hours later, it says it's at 100%, unplug it at that point in time. Okay, that's, I think, a more practical way of going about doing it. Now, this is something that modern computers and other devices that have lithium-ion batteries may be smart enough to take care of this on their own. A lot of computers, they will tell you that once it reaches 100% charge, it will stop trying to charge that battery. And it will wait until it's down to, say, something like 90% before it starts charging it again. So it may actually take care of this stuff on its own, but if you want to be sure, it's not a bad idea to, once it gets fully charged, unplug it, periodically run the battery down to 25% or so. I would say that, you know, if you do that every couple of weeks, that'll probably help the health of your battery. They say to avoid temperature extremes, both hot and cold, and minimize the amount of time that the battery is at either 100% or 0% charge. So that whole idea of ideally don't fully charge, don't fully discharge. And if you have fast chargers, they can degrade a battery more quickly. So in many cases, if you have a charger that is designed for that particular laptop, it probably is okay even if it's a fast charger, but batteries do like to be charged slowly. And so if you have a slower charger, it might help the health of your battery. And I think that's all I have on batteries.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah, I guess I would say this must be a fairly new computer. A lot of the old computers, you just kind of pull a clip and the battery came right out.
Yeah.
Or it was underneath a panel with a couple of screws. But these days, it seems as though they have a nice, clean base plate, and you normally have to take half a dozen screws out. And I've never come across one that's got glue, but they do have snap-in panels, and you basically have to use like a thin blade and pry the thing off. And it can be quite nerve-wracking trying to unclip the clips on a plastic panel and wonder whether you're going to actually break it rather than take it off in one piece. So I highly recommend YouTube for your particular model and see if you can find out how to actually do it if you're going to try and do it yourself. Okay, moving along, it's time for Tom Trottier to tell us all about tagging MP3 files. And Tom is going to unmute his microphone and share his screen and give his own presentation. I'm trying to drag it out so we're ready to go.
Okay, one moment.
There we go.
Shrink that and share screen. And yes. And yes. Okie dokes. My presentation is about MP3 tag, which is a freeware or donationware program. And it's good for tagging video and audio files. It's good for individual files, but you can, the big strength of it is that you can tag multiple files at a time, all the files in a directory, for example, or files that you choose. So you can update the tags or the file names. You can do batch editing of multiple files, for example, changing the the title or the album of it and so on for all the files in a directory, for example, or for the files you choose. You can also use regular expressions for replacing characters, so you can easily edit according to a pattern if you so choose. But as well as you making changes individually or in groups, you can do online database lookups from Discogs, MusicBrainz, or FreeDB for both tags and art. You can also rename the files based on the tags or change the tags based on the file name. You can create reports in HTML, RTF, which is revisable text format, which Word handles natively, or CSV, comma separated values, which Excel handles normally. It has full Unicode support, and you can renumber all your tracks. So if you've downloaded a multiple disc album, you can renumber all the tracks for the album and not just have it for numbered by the particular disc. Disc one, track one, disc two, track three, etc. You can have from 01 to 77. And there are many, 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 many tags. All of these are predefined tags that are available in for at least for MP3s and probably for other files. And as well as these, different programs add their own tags like iTunes. I'm not going to get into any of these particular ones. There are some common ones. But there's also multiple tag standards, ID3, V1, V2, 8, etc. And so these are, sometimes you want to, them to all hold to a particular standard that your player will handle. So if you're going to save common tags like this, title, artist, album, year, etc., if you want to edit these common tags, you can just type them in. Like, for example, this one, I put in the comment and the genre, and I've decided to blank out the disc number, and I've saved it in here with this particular thing, Control-S for save, and it's all gotten saved inside of these particular files. So you can do that because all of these were selected to start with, and you can tell they're selected by the gray background in this case. You can also try, especially for music, you can look at, you can look for cover art, you can go to Discogs and so on, and it will look it up on the basis of various things such as the hashtag of the audio or the based on the album or the title, along with the artist and the year. And then you can choose those things and populate them in the particular album that you're trying to put the right tracks in. So you don't have to always type in, for example, the title for each particular track. That will usually cover you. You can also go back and forth between tags and file names. So you can move a tag to a file name, such as putting the title as the file name. For example, here the file name is the same as the title. You can also go the other way, putting a file name to the tag, which is most useful when you've done a CD of some sort, and all your file names are CD track 01, CD track 02, and so on. And then the file name may be more meaningful than the particular tag, especially for multiple albums, and you can go that way. You can also file name to file name. Of course, that may not make any sense to you as you think it's they're the same, but you can also edit them. So you can put in substring and other things like that. So you can edit the file name by going file name to file name and put in substring or other text functions that do it. You can also do it from a text file to a tag. I've never tried that. And you can go from tag to tag. So you can go from, for example, the title, if it has the album in it, but the album isn't right, you can go from the title to create the album by deleting the stuff at the end, like the track number, and just using the first 20 or 30 characters for the album. You can also renumber the tracks into multi-disc albums, which I mentioned before. This is the auto-numbering track wizard. And here, they were numbered from 3 to 19. I've renumbered them, so this was a three-disc set. And I've numbered them from track 1 all the way to the last track, which is track 15. So I don't use it that much to do much editing of tags. I save the artist, album, year, comment to all tracks, because I usually just populate, for example, the first disc I copy for a multiple disc album. And then I copy, I copy all of that from the first thing to all of the other tracks. I copy file names, titles for all tracks. I renumber tracks in multiple disc albums or audiobooks, and I've used it now and then to fix any other problems in the tags where things are missing or wrong and I wanted to change it. And this is the URL you can use to access it. It's Donationware. I've given a donation, and if you use it more than once or twice, I encourage you to give a donation to this guy as well. Buy him a beer. He's in Germany, so beer is good. And that's it.
And if I can okay, thank you very much.
I'll be happy.
Yeah, don't see anything in the chat.
No. Okay, so the next item is Lawrence is going to tell us all we need to know about connections for computer displays. While he's setting that up, I'll just note that in the comments...
Chris, you need to give me...
Oh, sorry, Lawrence. Okay, you got it.
Thank you. Oh, okay. When you're ready, Alan.
Well, I don't have your slides. I was hoping you were going to share them.
I do. I thought you were in the middle of something before I interrupted you.
That's okay. You just, I'll come back to that later. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So this is more about cables. And, was it Richard? Yes, Richard was looking for an older VGA monitor, and that got me thinking, cables, how much I'd love to hate them. So, I thought, well, you know, that's probably a good time to get myself reacquainted with the various cables out there, including some that, we haven't used in a while. So with that being said, this is just going to be a very rough presentation. The links as to the sites I reference will be at the end. And
they're in the chat too.
Oh, you've copied them in the chat. Well, thank you. So and just realize, folks, I just pulled bits and pieces over. Think of it as a quick Google search as to why do I want to use DisplayPort or VGA or whatever? So let's start with DisplayPort. And you know what? I personally had issues with DisplayPort, mainly because when you're buying monitors, sometimes they came with them, sometimes they didn't. You had to be extra careful when, you know, if I'm buying for my organization, It's sometimes you got a monitor and you say, hey, I would love to, that monitor fits all the specs. Okay. Does it take DisplayPort? Half an hour later, I'm still scratching my head because they don't either include it in the specs or they have other specs from other monitors that may not be the same model as the one you're looking at. Yada, yada, yada. Anyways. But that said, well, let's take a look at why DisplayPorts are a big deal. And, you know, they are very similar to HDMI. I've used many an HDMI to DisplayPort converter and vice versa. They also come in mini DisplayPorts. And, hey, I have another reason to get peeved at Apple, because, of course, Apple came out with a mini DisplayPort. Why not? And then Dell had to come along and say, oh, okay, we're standardizing on display ports, but our docking stations are going to use mini display ports. Oh, wonderful. So anyways, take home from that is that one of the things I discovered is display port cables are optimized for up to 25 feet. Sorry?
Sorry.
Now, a couple of points with the DisplayPort. There's different versions. And I thought, oh, HDMI was the only one that had different versions. No. So as you can see here, we got a 1.2, we got a 1.3, 1.4. And as you can see, as they go up, they increase with various higher resolutions. And then another thing about display ports that now I sort of get why they're available is that they're great for using multiple displays. And I'm not going to go over the text I just grabbed and pasted here, but you guys can if anyone's interested in what the specs are for a display port. That's the whole point of this presentation. But the takeaway is that, yeah, we can do multiple displays for a thing called multiple stream transport and daisy chaining compatible monitors over DisplayPort. So if you want, I'm guessing that's how they do it in the conference rooms and so forth. Now we go to another favorite of mine, DVI. And, you know, I remember about 15 years ago, DVI came out. Maybe it was a little bit longer than that. And it was the big-ass cable that compared to VGA. But, of course, it had differences. And I've given up how many times I've had a different DVI cable only to find out, no, that's not the right DVI cable. And as you can see here, there's various versions of the DVI cable. And with the one on the bottom, I guess, is the equivalent, DVI-A is the equivalent of a VGA cable. So that would even, you know, if you're setting up monitors and so forth back 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and you're saying, well, VGA versus DVI, and you come across a DVI-A, I could hear a lot of cursing going on when you're forced to do something like that. Now, DVI does have the advantage of going up to about 50 feet. And as you can see, there's different variations of the DVI. Some are can handle bigger bandwidth. And so anyways, that's DVI. Then you get into HDMI, which happens to be one of the most popular ones out there. And you think, wow, why doesn't everybody just go standardize on HDMI? Well, now I have a little bit more respect for DisplayPort. I doubt the manufacturers used them to the extent that they said they could, but irregardless. So you got HDMI standing for high definition, and you typically have the type D. I think that's the type D that's being shown on the screen there. Anyways, and then you have the Type-C Mini and Type-A the largest. Okay, maybe I'm not sure which one is which here. So with the proper digital boosters, can transmit over 100 feet. But as many of us know, HDMI cable are typically between 3 to 25 feet. Another just broad thought that would be interested to broaden the pin layout. Now, the nice thing, the interesting thing about this, and I ran into this with my own 32K monitor, is that you have discussions as to whether what type of HDMI cable will properly work with your 32K monitor. As it turns out, you need an HDMI 2. And there's another example of, okay, I'll buy an HDMI 2. When I did go buying, of course, you know, trying to read through Amazon and so forth and the packaging, again, I ran into, this is HDMI 2 cable, except it's not. Well, what do you mean it's not? How can it be not when it is? Oh, well, we think we're not sure if it's 2. What do you mean you're not sure? Anyways, so long story short, folks, you do have to be careful. Just like I think we covered off a couple of months ago, the different USB-C standards and Thunderbolt and so forth, HDMI cables, you have to be careful as to what cables you get. Then we go back to the tried and true, at least up to about 10 years ago, VGA. Now, I have a whole bunch of monitors that are still have VGA. Of course, they're just sitting on a shelf gathering dust. But as you can see here, this brings back memory, the video graphic rays cable. I hadn't heard that term in many years. And it has 15 pins. It can do high quality video images between 15 and 30 feet. Some cables, and I've seen this, I've seen 50 foot cables. I don't know if I've seen a 100 foot VGA cable, but I have used a 50 foot cable before and it worked. Now, I probably wasn't using it for anything just other than standard, TV, not, you know, not 4K, not, extra high definition or however they call it now. But as you can see here, it's one of the oldest oldest of the connections, been back for decades. In fact, I remember purchasing my first, or for a company I was working for, the VGA to replace the EGA monitors. So anyways, and it goes up to 1920 by 1080 resolution, which is pretty standard now for most laptops. Here's my contributions, contributors. And that's it. I just thought we'd go down memory lane, and I bring out a challenge to people that have been dealing with cables longer than I have. I'd be very interested to hear your tales of cables woes. I mean, let's talk about parallel cables or serial cables or some of the big honking cables that, you know, I knew people would show me and say, oh, I'm just glad we're not using that anymore. Mm-hmm. Anyways, there's my challenge to others to take us down history and our memory lane, and then let us know why they're so glad they don't have to use those cables or connectors ever again. And that is my presentation.
Thanks very much, Lawrence. Anybody has any comments on that?
One of the things I found a little bit interesting, because I have computers and displays that can handle both HDMI as well as DisplayPort, and one of the things I found interesting is that a lot of the high-end video cards might have four or more DisplayPorts on them. I don't think I've ever seen anything with more than two HDMI ports for output. So if you are into lots of monitors, DisplayPort might be the way to go.
Yeah, till I read this, I do have an appreciation. Still despise them because I don't get into multiple monitors, but yeah, I understand why they exist.
I think you can also daisy chain display port, so you can only have one cable leading from your computer to the one monitor and then have another cable or two or three chained along, to multiple monitors. Now, Lawrence, we're waiting for, now that you've solved everything with video cable stuff, I'd like to see wireless explained.
That would be, well, you know what? I imagine in the, maybe next year I'll do a wireless thing again to do an update on the presentation I did a year ago, I guess it was.
Actually, Lawrence, Tim's suggesting that you might want to talk next about the adapters.
Adapters?
Yeah, when you convert from one to another.
Yeah. I'll take that in consideration. We'll see if I get. I'll see if I get bored in the next couple of months.
Okay. Thanks very much, Lawrence. Okay, so we did have another question came in that Chris and I don't have an answer to. But if anybody has a Wi-Fi 6 router, here's the question. This gentleman, Orion Clark, he has a Wi-Fi 6 router. The instructions say that WPS will be disabled if you use a WPA3 security. And also some devices like scanners and printers may not function with WPA3. So the question is that information accurate? Or does he have to conduct a trial and error testing to find out? And he also thinks that some websites may not function properly. Is that true? In the meantime, he's left things alone at WPA2. So I don't think neither Chris or I have access to Wi-Fi 6, nor what WPA3, as far as I know. So if anybody has the answers to that.
Yeah, I haven't seen any WPA3 devices myself, but it doesn't really surprise me that they say certain devices won't work if you go to WPA3, because if the device doesn't support WPA3, unless there is a backwards compatibility, which I suspect, seeing as they seem to be talking about security, so they're adding, layering in additional security. Well, if you're enforcing security that another device that wants to connect doesn't know about, then it doesn't surprise me at all that some devices won't work properly if you lock it to WPA3. That I think is almost to be expected. I'd be really surprised if some websites wouldn't function properly though. I mean, it's just transmitting your TCP/IP traffic. The whole idea of the WPA is authentication and encryption. Over the wireless between your device that is connecting to the hub or the router and the router itself. So, I can't imagine how it would affect connection to certain websites. But devices wouldn't surprise me. If anybody else knows more? Oh, Tom pasted in a link to a PC Magazine article on WPA3. So that might be worth checking out. Orion, if you're on the call. I don't see Orion by name. But anyhow, information there. Oh, finalized in 2018. So from Wi-Fi standards point of view, that's actually fairly recent. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at it myself. And to your point, it's the security. So yeah, websites, let's put it this way. Anything that's just depending on the network connection shouldn't be a problem. If it's device specific, I could see printers probably not working with it.
Yep.
Knowing the way printers are very sensitive to just working within their narrow band of, what was considered the current technology?
Well, I really suspect anything that has to connect to your wireless network could definitely be affected. But by and large, I have not looked into WPA3 at all, but I mean, WPA2 with AES encryption is not bad. I mean, there were some security concerns about it and so forth that I presume are, but it's not like, a remote hacker could come in and take over your network just because you're using WPA2. WPA2 security is still not bad security. So
my reading of it is that websites should work properly, but it's devices and so on that are connecting directly to your router or your computer. If it's WPA3 only, then they may not be able to connect if they're not WPA3.
Yeah.
But I have never used it, so I don't have any direct knowledge.
Yeah. I think by and large, if all your devices work properly, connecting to the network that you need to connect to the network, then I would say fine, go with it. But if you have any problems with any of them, backing off to WPA2 is a reasonable solution to the problem.
Okay, so we've reached that last 10 minutes.
And we're right on 10 minutes.
We're about ready for more questions. So just before we do that, while you're thinking about your questions and posting them in the chat for Chris to look at, there are a few things came up in the comments. Lawrence asked about ejecting safely and whether that icon would sit on the taskbar if there was no flash drive plugged in. And it turns out that mine's always there, but that's because I have an SD card plugged in permanently, which I use for a real-time backup solution. If I take that if I eject safely that SD card, then the icon, in fact, does disappear from the taskbar. Interestingly enough, though, when I plug the SD card back in, the icon magically reappears. So once you've dragged it to the taskbar, that's where it thinks it lives. USB floppy drives. It's possible, I think Tom mentioned, to buy a USB, at least 3.5-inch floppy drive, which you can just plug into a USB port, and then you will have drive A. Somebody asked whether there was also a 5.25. I've never seen a 5.25 USB. I don't know that anybody knows whether such a beast exists.
Mm.
Certainly if you have a desktop, there's lots of 5.25 drives around that you can plug into a drive bay. Then the only trick is to find some 5.25 floppy disks. Tom also mentioned maybe demagnetizing the floppies using a tape recorder head. And Tim suggested you could actually try selling the software on eBay. Don't know how much market there is for really old programs, but who knows. And somebody told me that the thin blade that I mentioned to take laptops apart is actually called a spudger.
Mm.
So if you need to take a laptop apart, you clearly need a spudger. I don't know if they have any other questions.
I think Michelin had something on there for the last 10.
That's a question that was posted originally in the members forum earlier today. I think I haven't had a chance to look at it.
I'm just trying to find it here.
With Excel. I'm trying to find it here.
Yeah, here it is. How do you open all 8 tabs in the format comment dialog in Excel? You're supposed to get 8 tabs, including colors and lines tab. If you select a cell, right-click, select insert comment, and then right-click and select format comment from the context menu. And she only gets the font tab. So if anybody knows how you would change that to get all 8 tabs, I have no clue myself. So if anybody has an idea on that, you could either chime in or put it into the chat. While we're waiting about that, Bob Gowan just chimed in on the 5.25-inch drive. How about using an enclosure with a salvaged internal 5.25-inch drive? Problem with that, I guess, is that the interface to it, you want it to go to a USB interface, and so you need something that will do the conversion. It could well be that if you have one that was a 3.25-inch cabling inside, you could tear it apart and use that to do the conversion from floppy to USB, I guess.
Oh,
it definitely is different cabling.
Speaking of the floppies, you want to make sure when you do buy an external floppy drive that it works in Windows 7 and above. Some of the older ones do not work in the higher and the newer versions.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And the 5 1/4, I've looked on eBay many times. I've seen... the 5 1/4. I've seen lots of them, but there's some people are selling them for a couple $100.
Wow.
Because they're hard to, I think they're just plain hard to find. It's been such a long time.
Yeah.
I have an adaptable 5 1/4 for my ThinkPad Butterfly, but I haven't used it in the last 10 years or more.
Actually,
I know the answer to my question at 8:23 p.m. It was in the original question, but Chris ignored it. 8:23.
Right here. How do you open an image pop-up on a mouse over in either Word or Excel? So you have an image in the document, you hover the mouse over it, and what happens?
I'm trying to open an image by putting mouse over. I can't find anything in Word, but the method in Excel doesn't work.
Have you tried right-clicking?
Tried what?
Hello, Microsoft.
Try right-clicking.
Right-clicking what?
The image.
Well, the image isn't there. It's only supposed to come up when you right-click or if you mouse over. It's done all the time on the web. It's just I don't know how to do it in Word or Excel.
I think if you left click on the image to select it, then you should be able to copy it with a right click right after it's selected.
And then what?
Then paste it to wherever you want to paste it.
I'm not trying to paste it. I'm only trying to have it visible when you mouse over. I'm trying
to see. Mousing over a link?
No, she wants it to appear when the mouse is on top of it, but to disappear otherwise. I think that's only a web thing. I don't think it's in Word. In the web, you can do all kinds of funny stuff with CSS, but Word and Excel are more constrained.
Agreed.
Hey, we have a couple of other things that have come into the chat. Tom was asking if anybody has, if I can scroll back down to it. So does anybody use pfSense or OpenSense with a gigabit plus connection? So if anybody has any experience with that, you could unmute yourself or answer in the chat. And Lawrence has, going back to WPA3, he says that there is transitional mode available on some routers, which will allow all your devices to connect. So newer devices that are capable of WPA3 will use that, and devices limited to WPA2 will connect with that, which makes sense to have a transitional period where, you want to allow all your devices to continue to connect. And Bob Harris, I don't think we can help you that you have your 8-inch Dyson floppy disk. I think you're on your own on that one.
Well, to the point about why floppy drives are so expensive, Ask Woody had an article in which a guy was basically explaining how someone came in with an old computer that was running a tens of thousands of dollars piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. And basically it was the only way of keeping the equipment going. And he has a very good write up on how he had to take it apart, clean it. He had to find the parts, including the floppy drives that were worth several hundred dollars. and put it all back together and his time and so forth. I mean, but it was to the manufacturer, it was all worth it in the end because the alternative was probably more than $100,000 worth of work, you know, replacement and of course replacing the machine and so forth for what is literally just a computer replacement. And the machine was like 2 decades old or something like that.
I remember one time Microsoft was going to drop a protocol. I forget what it was. And they going from one version of the operating system to the next. It was fairly old protocol. And they were going to drop it. And some big multinational said that if you drop that, you have something like 250,000 PCs we're not going to upgrade. And Microsoft relented and left the protocol in place.
Jeez.
8-inch floppies are 40 years old or more, 40-plus years old. They're originally used to boot up IBM mainframes with the microcode. Mm. So that was their original use.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. If you want to recycle your floppy disks, just take a magnet and rub it over the top and bottom. And it won't necessarily erase everything, but it will scramble up the data so bad that it can't be properly read. So it's a quick and easy way to make sure you're not passing over any confidential information.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea.
Okay, so we've hit the magic 8:30, people. So I'm going to wrap up. Just remind you that in a couple of weeks, we have our regular December meeting, and Stefan is going to be talking about TCP/IP. If you have some cash to spare or you want to donate some actual food, the Oshawa Food Bank would love to hear from you, either directly at Michael Street or by donating online. And the final thing we have is next week, next Wednesday, December the 7th, will be our next Q&A. So if you have questions that we can answer, send them along and we'll see what we can do. Send them along anyway. We'll see what we can do.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.